Something fundamental broke in America around 1980, and most of us missed it happening in real time. For 3 decades after World War II, when workers became more productive, they earned more money. Simple as that. A factory worker could buy a house, support a family, and retire with dignity. Then the rules changed. Productivity kept climbing, corporate profits soared, but paychecks flatlined. The average CEO went from earning 20 times what their workers made to over 300 times as much. This wasn't an accident or natural evolution, it was engineered. A 1971 memo from future Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell warned that American business faced an existential threat and needed to fight back aggressively. Wealthy heirs and corporate leaders took this seriously, methodically funding think tanks, reshaping legal theory, and rewriting the social contract that had created the largest middle class in history. The 1970s brought inflation, oil shocks, and cultural exhaustion after the turbulent 60s. Americans felt overwhelmed by rapid change and increasingly receptive to promises of stability through lower taxes and less regulation. Business leaders, feeling besieged by new environmental and safety rules, organized with unprecedented coordination. In 1973, CEOs of America's largest corporations formed the Business Roundtable, requiring personal CEO participation in lobbying, no more delegating to underlings. This wasn't your grandfather's chamber of commerce. This was a precision instrument for reshaping policy. The shift in public opinion was dramatic. By 1978, 58% of Americans believed government had gone too far in regulating business, up from 42% a decade earlier. Picture America in the 1950s and 60s, the economic reality, not sanitized nostalgia. This was the Great Compression, when income inequality decreased and prosperity spread broadly. A 30-year-old in 1970 had a 92% chance of out-earning their parents. Companies like IBM and AT&T promised lifetime employment with pensions and healthcare. Unions represented over a third of private sector workers. Top tax rates exceeded 70%, yet businesses thrived and innovation flourished. This wasn't socialism. It was capitalism with guardrails, where countervailing powers kept any single interest from dominating. Strong unions negotiated fair wages. Antitrust enforcement prevented monopolies. Glass-Steagall kept banking stable. Progressive taxation funded infrastructure and education. When workers earned decent wages, they bought products, creating demand that fueled growth. The virtuous cycle seemed unbreakable until it broke. Even with Democrats controlling Congress and the presidency, 101 Democratic representatives voted against creating a consumer protection agency while slashing capital gains taxes, signaling both parties had accepted a new economic philosophy prioritizing investor returns over worker security. Ronald Reagan's 1980 victory transformed America's economic foundations through tax cuts and drift, deliberately not updating policies as the economy evolved, funneling wealth upward. The pivotal moment came in 1981 when Reagan fired 13,000 striking air traffic controllers and banned them from federal employment forever. This revived permanently replacing striking workers. Within years, over a third of strike-facing companies threatened permanent replacement. Strikes virtually disappeared. Union membership collapsed from 25% to just 6% of private workers today, eliminating workers' primary tool for sharing productivity gains. While Americans focused on elections, a quieter revolution unfolded in courtrooms. A year after the Powell memo, law students at Yale, Harvard, and Chicago founded the Federalist Society with Antonin Scalia as faculty advisor. Funded by right-wing billionaires, it created a pipeline of like-minded lawyers and judges reshaping American law. Two legal theories became weapons for economic restructuring. Originalism claimed the Constitution should be interpreted as Americans in 1789 understood it, while Robert Bork's antitrust reinterpretation reduced a century of jurisprudence to one question: do consumers pay lower prices? This ignored market concentration, worker rights, and democratic values. Before the 1970s, Wall Street was a boring service industry marked by prudence. Then investment banks went public, creating a bonus culture where employees took massive risks with other people's money. When you're paid on annual profits, regardless of long-term consequences, prudence becomes irrational. Paying executives in stock made them obsess over share prices. Until the late 1960s, only 20% received modest stock options. By the late 1990s, stock constituted half of executive compensation, eventually reaching two-thirds. Top executive pay grew modestly from $1.4 million to $1.8 million between the 1940s and 1970s, then exploded to $13 million by the early 2000s and $30 million in the 2010s. In 1982, the SEC eliminated restrictions on stock buybacks. The largest U.S. companies went from spending 4% of profits on buybacks in the early 1980s to 50% in the 90s and 89% by 2017. During the last decade, U.S. airlines spent 96% of available cash on buybacks, while executives personally sold $1.6 billion of shares. Buybacks now cost around $1 trillion annually, three times what businesses spend on research and development. For centuries, technological advances boosted worker productivity and prosperity. During the three decades after World War II, U.S. productivity doubled, the economy doubled, and average incomes doubled in tandem. Then, around 1980, came the Great Uncoupling. Productivity and economic growth continued rising, nearly doubling since the 1970s, but most Americans' incomes flatlined for 40 years. Only the top fifth saw their incomes rise as before. The share of national income going to employees dropped from 60% to approaching 50%, amounting to nearly $1 trillion annually, or about $5,000 per worker. Meanwhile, households in the top 1% gained an extra $700,000 yearly. This represented the largest upward redistribution of wealth in history, yet it happened so gradually that many didn't notice. Employers developed subtler tactics. Outsourcing blue-collar service work to private contractors became widespread. Harvard, which had employed thousands of unionized workers, began outsourcing these jobs to contractors paying lower wages. A 2018 study found that fully one-third of America's increased income inequality over the past 40 years stems from this single practice. Americans are more economically progressive than assumed. When shown unlabeled charts comparing wealth distribution in America versus Sweden, 92% chose Sweden when asked where they'd prefer to live if randomly assigned a position. Polls reveal Americans want more Wall Street regulation by 3-1, believe corporations pay too little in taxes, and nearly two-thirds support wealth taxes on the extremely rich. In a hypothetical America with perfect economic equality, every household would have $800,000 net worth and $140,000 annual income. Everyone would be upper middle class. This reveals how rich America is and how badly we've distributed that wealth. The pandemic exposed the failure of market fundamentalist axioms adopted around 1980, that market value is the only value, that democracy should stay out of economics, that government is useless. Between 15-30% of current jobs may disappear within two decades to automation, yet we're told to trust the market. The top income tax rate dropped from 70% to 28%, while corporate taxes were cut in half, changes that compounded over decades, fundamentally restructuring who wins and loses in America. We face a crossroads as profound as the 1970s. The question isn't whether America will change. Change is inevitable. But whether we'll address chronic economic insecurity and inequality, or retreat into stasis. We don't need catastrophe to rebuild the countervailing powers that once made capitalism work for everyone. Strong unions, progressive taxation, antitrust enforcement, financial regulation. The Supreme Court's adoption of Bork's view neutered antitrust enforcement and turned labor laws into annoyances, enabling the near collapse of the labor movement. This legal revolution restructured economic life through courts rather than democratic processes. transforming the economy into high-stakes musical chairs where only winners receive rewards. Shared prosperity isn't naive idealism. It's historical fact. We built it before. We can build it again. Our task is not to lay aside the dream, but to make it plausible, to transform hopeful visions into reality once more.